This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents I Will Always Write Back, How One Letter Changed Two Lives. Written by Caitlin Alaferenka and Martin Gonda, with Liz Welsh. Read by Chukwudi Iwuji and Emily Bauer. This book is dedicated to our mothers, Anne Neville and Chioniso Gonda, and our fathers, Richard Stoichitz and George Gonda.
Part 1. Hello.
September 1997. Caitlin. I'd never heard of Zimbabwe, but something about the way the name looked up on the blackboard intrigued me. It was exotic and difficult to pronounce. It was also the last country in a long list that Mrs. Miller had written in chalk. She asked each student in my 7th grade English class to pick one place for a pen pal program our school was starting that year. I was sitting toward the back row. Usually I spent that period passing notes with Lauren, my best friend, or staring out the window daydreaming about boys. It was late September, and the leaves on the trees were beginning to turn from vibrant green to rusty red and mustard yellow. I was an average student. If I applied myself, I did well. Honestly, I was not all that interested in school, but there was something almost magnetic about this crazy-sounding place. Zimbabwe. I raised my hand. Caitlin, Mrs. Miller said, surprised. She usually had to call on me to participate. How do you pronounce the last country? I asked. The one that starts with a Z. Zimbabwe, she said, sounding it out like it was three words.
It's in Africa.
Oh, cool, I said. I had a hunch it was there, but couldn't name any other countries on the continent. I had a good handle on Europe, as my family had gone to Germany the summer before to visit my dad's relatives. On the same trip, we went to Switzerland, Austria, Liechtenstein, and France. Other than several trips to Canada, that was my first trip abroad, and it was a huge deal. I'd never imagined traveling to Africa, or even wondered what life must be like there. I had no idea, and that was all the more exciting. Like the beginning of an adventure. That's the one I want, I said. I didn't know it then. How could I have? But that moment would change my life. Before then, I was a typical 12-year-old American girl, far more interested in what I should wear to school than what I might learn there. I assumed most kids, regardless of where they lived, had lives similar to mine. And while I imagined that Zimbabwe was radically different from suburban Pennsylvania, where I grew up, I had no idea how much. My knowledge of Africa consisted of what I had seen in the National Geographic magazines my mother subscribed to for our family. I loved looking at the colorful photos of tribal people who wore face paint, loincloths, and beads. I didn't think my pen pal would dress like that. But I had no idea what kids in Africa wore. Jeans like me? I had so many questions. I was born and raised in Hatfield, Pennsylvania, a small, middle-class town 40 miles outside Philadelphia. Both my parents grew up there as well. They met in elementary school but didn't start dating until college. After they got married, they moved to neighboring Lansdale, which was more affordable than Hatfield. My brother, Richie, was born there. By the time I came around 5 years later, they had moved back to Hatfield and bought the home they still live in today. There was no reason to ever move. Hatfield was a great place to live. Quiet streets lined with ranch and colonial-style houses with well-kept yards, a good public school, and an old-timey downtown with a deli called the Trolley Stop. There was a Dairy Queen within walking distance of my house, and I'd often meet Lauren there for blizzards on the weekends. Otherwise, Miles of farmland surrounded Hatfield, even though it was less than an hour away from a major American city. Truthfully, we rarely went to Philadelphia because there was so much to do in Hatfield, whether softball games on the weekends, roller skating at the local rink, or just hanging out with friends at the nearby mall. My summer trip to Europe did give me some sense of a world beyond suburban Pennsylvania, though. When I was in Germany, I was struck by how different my cousin Carola was from me. Like me, Carola was tall and blonde, but when I first met her, she was wearing cut-off jean shorts and dark brown knee socks with sandals. I thought she looked ridiculous. She also spoke English with a harsh-sounding accent, like she was always angry. She ate sharp cheese and dark bread for breakfast, and liked chocolate with hazelnuts and salty black licorice, nothing like the Hershey's Kisses and Starburst sweets I had grown up with. I assumed she was a total dork, until I went to school with her one day. The school year started in early August, and as soon as we walked into the building, everyone said hello to her, including all the cute boys. She was actually really popular, and many of her girlfriends were also wearing knee socks with sandals. It was fashionable. Meanwhile, I knew if I showed up at school wearing that outfit, people would say, "Why are you dressed like a nerd? Halloween isn't until October." That trip opened my eyes to other ways of living beyond my small town. Everything and everyone in Hatfield felt so familiar, even a little boring. I wanted to learn about somewhere radically different, and having a pen pal in Africa seemed like a great way to do that. Mrs. Miller went around the room, calling on people. Lauren picked Germany, as did many other kids in our class who had some ancestral connection. A few kids picked France, and others picked Italy and England. By the time everyone had chosen, I realized that I was the only person who had picked a country in Africa. I think it shocked my teacher, who had already busted me twice that year for chewing gum in class, and once for passing a note to Lauren. Each time I was caught, I was slightly embarrassed. In seventh grade, I just wanted to blend in. I joined the field hockey team because all my friends were on it, even though I did not like running up and down a big field bent over a stick. I guess my trip to Europe had changed me. For the first time, I saw that being different wasn't a bad thing. It was actually kind of cool. Our homework assignment that night was to write a letter to our new pen pal. Since we did not know who would be receiving our letters, Mrs. Miller said to simply write, "Hello," instead of "Dear so-and-so." I was actually excited about homework, maybe for the first time ever. That afternoon, I sat on the bus next to Heather, my other best friend, who was a year older and lived two houses away from me. I told her about my pen pal assignment. "That's so cool," she said. "What are you going to ask?" It was a good question. I had no idea what to write or where to start. I thought about it as the bus pulled out of the school driveway. Penfield Middle School is just down the street from Hatfield Quality Meats, a pig slaughterhouse, which my school bus passed every morning and afternoon. That meant most days I could see the pigs, some as big as miniature ponies, arriving on the back of huge livestock trucks, their pink and whiskered noses sticking through the metal crates. That image, and the squealing sounds they made as if they knew what would come next, always broke my heart. But the rendering days were even worse. The air filled with the stench of garbage cooked in bacon. The smell would stick to your hair and clothes, like cigarette smoke, as it wafted into our classroom's open windows on warm days back when our school didn't have air conditioning. I certainly would not write about that. It was the one thing I didn't like about my hometown. Hatfield was also known for its dairy farms, which I much preferred. I pressed my forehead against the window As the bus passed by rolling green fields dotted with black and white cows grazing. They had much better lives than the pigs, I thought. I wondered what my pen pal saw on her or his way to school. I knew there were elephants and giraffes in Africa. Were they like our cows, grazing on the side of the road? There was so much I wanted to find out. 20 minutes later, the bus stopped at the end of my street, a cul-de-sac. I knew every family in each of the 12 houses that lined the road. In the summer, I played flashlight tag and kickball with other neighborhood kids. In the winter, when it snowed, we'd build snowmen in one another's front yards. My family's house was beige, with navy blue shutters and a matching front door, which we hardly ever used. Instead, I always went in through the side door. There, Kava and Romeo, our two giant schnauzers, would always be waiting for me, doing their welcome dance, which entailed wagging their whole bodies and jumping up and down at the same time. They followed me through the laundry room that was also a mud room for all our coats and boots, and then into the family room, where they returned to their still warm spots on our couch. As always, I threw my backpack at the bottom of the stairs, one of my mom's rules, before heading into the kitchen to grab a snack. My mom was always home when I arrived. Before I was born, she worked as an office manager for a doctor in town. Then, when I was still a baby, she decided to go back to school to become a teacher. She wanted to be home when Richie and I finished school every afternoon, and she wound up getting a job as an elementary school teacher in Central Bucks School District in the neighboring county. Now that I was in middle school, I didn't see her during the day, but I always found her waiting for me in the kitchen when I came home. That afternoon, she was sitting at the kitchen table, reading the newspaper. "How was your day?" she asked, peering up at me, her big blue-green eyes gentle but curious. Most days I filled her in on my softball game schedule or complained about too much homework or mean teachers. But on this day, I had something interesting to report. "I got a pen pal today," I said, "from Zimbabwe." "Where?" she asked. "In Africa, Mom," I said, and rolled my eyes. I couldn't believe she did not know where Zimbabwe was. She was a teacher, after all. "Oh, do you mean Rhodesia?" she asked. My mom went to get a world map from the living room, which she laid across the table. "Rhodesia," she said, pointing to a tea kettle-shaped country in the southern part of Africa, above a place called Botswana and next to one called Mozambique. My mom then pointed to the date on the map, 1977. It was 20 years old. "Countries in Africa change all the time," she said in a matter-of-fact way. She mentioned colonialism, a vaguely familiar word. "What does that mean again?" I asked. "It's when powerful countries take over other countries and call them their territories," she explained. "Like America. It used to be a British colony, but we fought for our freedom. The Zimbabweans did the same thing." I had studied American history the year before, but I was having a hard time making the connection. It was all very confusing, but one thing was clear. I needed to learn a little more about this faraway place before I could even begin writing my letter. I didn't want to seem stupid. When my dad was not traveling for work, he arrived home every night at 6. He worked on energy contracts for the government, which sounds as mysterious as it was. All I knew was that he had top government security clearance, and he could not talk about his work with anyone, including us. My brother, Richie, was 17 years old and a junior in high school. He usually hung out with his friends after school, but he was always home in time for dinner. That was another one of my mom's rules. We ate dinner together every evening at 6:30. And then afterward, my dad logged on to the family computer, a beige Dell the size of a television set. My parents kept it in the den, as my mother had read about predators posing as kids in chat rooms and wanted to monitor the websites Richie and I used. Back then, we had dial-up internet, which took forever. And then, once we were connected, everyone took turns using the computer. That evening, I went first. I waited for the snap, crackle, pop, "You've got mail," sound sequence, and then typed Zimbabwe into a search engine, which led me to the Encyclopedia Britannica site. My mom had a subscription, which meant I could access information. That's how I discovered that Zimbabwe was liberated from the United Kingdom in 1980. I was beginning to see parallels. The Africans wanted to be free from British rule, just as colonial Americans did 200 years earlier. I read that more than 90% of the Zimbabwean people were called Shona, but that there was another tribe called Ndebele, which I think was pronounced Ndebele. Shona was the country's national language, but most people spoke English as a result of being colonized. Phew, I thought. At least my pen pal would be able to understand me. I wondered which tribe my pen pal was from, and what it meant to be from one or the other. Could you be both? Was it like being German and Irish, like me? It was getting late, so instead of doing more research, I went upstairs to my room to start writing. There, I took out a piece of lined school paper and sat on the bottom of my bunk bed, where I usually did my homework. I began, "Hi, my name is Caitlin. I'm 12 years old. I live in Hatfield, Pennsylvania. I'm in the 7th grade. My brother, Richie, is in 11th grade." I paused. What else should I write to this person halfway across the world? I scanned my room for inspiration and spotted my collection of sports trophies won over the years, usually for good sportsmanship, as I was never the best player, or even very athletic. I continued, "I play softball and soccer and field hockey." I did not include that I had started taking stats for my field hockey team because it hurt my back to bend over the stick all the time. I was already 5'3", the second tallest girl in my class. My posters tacked to the wall caught my attention, so I continued, "I like the Spice Girls and the Backstreet Boys, and my favorite color is pink." This was all true. My mother had stenciled pink hearts on my walls, and the rug in my room was magenta, though no one would ever know, since it was completely covered in clothes. I continued, "For fun, I like to go shopping at the mall on the weekend. I also like to go roller skating and bowling with my friends, and to eat pizza. What do you like to do for fun? And what is it like in Zimbabwe?" I knew there was more to ask and tell, but this was a good start. I signed it the way Mrs. Miller had showed us earlier that day. Sincerely, Caitlin Stoichitz. When I turned in my letter to Mrs. Miller the following day, I felt giddy, like this was the start of something big.
October 1997. Martin. Mrs. Jarai entered our classroom smiling. "Class, I have pen pal letters from America," she said in a chipper voice. It was mid-October and toward the end of our school year, so this was a welcome surprise. Everyone started chattering. We all knew and loved America. It was the land of Coca-Cola and the WWF World Wrestling Federation. Kids with money would Xerox different wrestling photos from American magazines they found in town, and then sell them to other students. It was very popular to have an 8x10 black and white copy of Hulk Hogan. He was considered a god in Zimbabwe. My older brother, Nation, managed to get one somehow, and we hung it on our wall at home using bubble gum as tape. It was a status thing. "Do you have Hulk Hogan or Macho Man?" This was my view of America. Men with big muscles who wore skull caps and knee-high boots and made lots of money. The big life. I wanted to know what kids my age were like in this faraway country. Mrs. Jarai only had 10 letters, and there were 50 students in our classroom. I was in group 1, so I was one of the lucky ones. The school year in Zimbabwe starts in January, when every student takes a placement test. The kids with the highest scores are put in group 1. I had been in that group for the last 8 years, since first grade. My mother made sure of it. On my very first day of school, when I was 6, she kept asking, "Who is the best teacher?" An older woman was pointed out, and my mother approached her and said, "This is my son, Martin. Make sure he is in your class." It worked. I wound up in that class. At the end of first grade, there was a ceremony where the top 3 students were named. Number 3 was announced first, then number 2. When my name was called for number 1, I heard a joyous cry from behind me. I turned to see my mother jumping up and down like a rabbit, ululating, which is how we celebrate. I had to hold back a smile as her high-pitched cries, "Yeah! Yeah! Yeah!" pushed me toward the front of the crowd where I received my certificate. On our way home, my mother said, "Martin, if you want to do well in life, you must always be number 1. I was number 1 again the following year, but then in grade 3, I took second place. "Why didn't you take number 1? My mother asked the day I got my report card. Her face screwed so tight her eyes were squinted slits. "The other guy is very clever," I explained, handing it to her. She swatted it out of my hand with such ferocity, I was startled. I watched the paper as it fluttered to the floor and kept my eyes there as she shouted, "That's no excuse. Next you'll be number 5, then number 14. You must work harder." "I will, Mai," I said, still stunned. I picked up the paper and smoothed it out on my thigh before trying to give it to her one more time. "I don't want to look at it," she said, quiet this time, but still fierce. "Or you." As I turned to leave, the report crumpled in my hand. She whispered, "School is your only hope." She took a deep breath and finished her thought. "Otherwise, you will end up like me." I understood. My mother wasn't being unkind. She was being protective. My mother was smart, but she had to drop out of school when she was 12 because her parents could not afford the fees. My parents were also poor, but at least I was still in school. I promised her and myself that I would always work as hard as possible. The next semester, I pushed myself and was number 1 from that year onward. That meant I always got to sit in the front row of our classroom. Since there were so many kids and not much room, 4 students shared a desk meant for 1. It was crowded, but it made it easier to share textbooks. The teacher had only 4, which she brought to class every day. I often stayed after school to take notes to make sure I understood what was being taught. We were very rarely allowed to take the books home. They were too precious. Everyone in Group 1 got a letter from America, but then Mrs. Jarai ran out, leaving the last 4 groups with nothing. I felt especially fortunate that I was in the classroom that morning. Due to the overcrowding in our school, each group was also split into teams, 1A, B, C, and D. That meant every day, 2 teams would start classes inside and then finish outside beneath a big baobab tree. Our teacher would travel with us and sit in a chair as we sat cross-legged in the dirt and listen to her read passages from textbooks or lecture us on a topic. On sunny days, it was actually quite pleasant. But when it rained, we had to move into the hallways, which was not as fun. The other team started outside and finished in. This was called hot sitting and was common throughout Zimbabwe. Mrs. Jarai handed me the first letter and asked me to read it out loud. We learned English in school. Zimbabwe used to be a British colony, but I spoke Shona with my family and friends. Mutare, where I lived, was 99% Shona. I knew how to speak English, but used it only in this class, so the words felt funny in my mouth. I tried to mimic the voices I had heard on the radio and television, high-pitched and nasally. "Hello, my name is Caitlin," I began. It was such a strange name that everyone laughed. I had never heard of Pennsylvania and had a difficult time pronouncing it. But then I got to the part where she listed the sports she played and smiled. We had something in common. I played soccer daily with my friends, but had never heard of field hockey and was not sure how to say the word. Field hooky, I tried. Hockey, Mrs. Jarai corrected me before I continued. I also really like the Spice Girls. Do you know them? Baby Spice is my favorite. Someone sang, If You Want to Be My Lover, and everyone laughed, including our teacher. The Spice Girls were very popular in Zimbabwe. What is life like in Zimbabwe? I hope you write me back. Sincerely, Caitlin Stoichitz. The class burst out in laughter again as I tried to pronounce her last name. Mrs. Jarai just shook her head, smiled, and said, I cannot help you with that one. Mrs. Jarai told those of us who had gotten letters to craft a response and bring it back the following day. I always loved homework, but this felt more important than any regular school assignment. I had a new friend in America. That afternoon, I walked home with a bunch of other kids who lived near me in Shisamba Singles. It was a housing development built in the 1960s as a place for men from the rural areas to stay during the week while they worked in different factories on the outskirts of Mutare, the third largest city in Zimbabwe. My father had arrived there in 1980, after my older brother Nation was born. My mother grew up in a rural village several hours north of Mutare, near the Chimanimani Mountains. She had two older brothers and one sister. She was very clever and always was first in her class. The problem was that her family was dirt poor. They had no electricity and bathed in the rivers. My mother stayed in school until fifth grade, but then her family could no longer afford to send her. She dropped out, and soon after, they sent her to work for my father's family because they could no longer afford to feed her either. She was 12 years old. Or rather, my mother thought she was around that age, as there is no formal record of her birth. She was born in her family's hut, as were her brothers and sister. This is how some people in rural areas of Zimbabwe are born. And it was also common to send children to work for other families, one fewer mouth to feed. My mother worked in exchange for her food and keep, which still happens today. My father grew up in a nearby village, and while his family wasn't wealthy, they at least had goats and chickens. They were rich compared to my mother's family. She was around 14 years old when she got pregnant with Nation. My father was 24. It was not like my parents fell in love. In Zimbabwe, if a woman becomes pregnant, our Shona tradition requires that she get married, or else she brings shame on both families. Basically, my father was forced to marry her. I don't think it was a choice for either of them. And I know it was why my mom was also very strict about any interactions with girls. I was not allowed to talk to them or play with them, or even look at them. Shortly after Nation was born, my dad left the village for Mutare to find work. He got a job at Mutare Board and Paper Mills, the biggest paper mill in Zimbabwe, which was how he wound up at Chisamba Singles. He shared a room with another man. There were four rooms per housing unit. The men worked hard, saved their money, and then headed home once a month with groceries and money for their families. My father's original goal was to save enough to build a house in his village, but apparently he started to misbehave. My father liked to drink, and he liked women. So the story goes that his every month visit home became every 6 months. During one, my mother got pregnant with their second son, who died a few days after he was born. People said terrible things to my father, like, why keep a wife who bears dead babies? They even told him to get a new wife. Culturally, any issue around childbirth was the woman's fault, whether the child was crippled or he died. Polygamy was not common back then, but it also was not a big deal. My father's brother, Uncle Sam, had to get a second wife because his first wife only gave him one child. But my mom was stubborn. After she lost her second son, she insisted on moving to Mutare, into the one-room shack that my dad shared with another man. They put up a curtain in the center of the room, and my parents lived on one side with Nation, and our roommate, Mr. Dambudzo, lived on the other. I was born there in 1983, 3 years after Zimbabwe was liberated, which meant I was one of the born frees. That was what people called children who were born after liberation from British colonial powers. In Zimbabwe, there's often some kind of direct significance to your name. Nation was named after my father's favorite cow. I was lucky. A medical student from England delivered me, and his name was Martin. If you were born on a Friday, you could be called Friday. Or if you were born during a dry period, you could be named Drought. I knew people called Disaster and Weakness. I have a Shona name as well. It's Tatenda, which means thank you. Nation's other name is Tawanda, which means we are many. He actually named our other brother Simba, which means power in Shona. His English name is Mac, my grandfather's name. And then Lois, my sister, was named after my aunt. Her Shona name is Hekani, which means surprise, like, whoa, finally a girl. And then the youngest, George, was named for my father. George does not have a Shona name. I think my parents were too tired by then to think of one. My father was not the only person to bring his entire family to Shisamba Singles. Soon, everyone did this, including his roommate, who had two wives. Each wife would swap every 2 weeks, commuting back and forth from the rural areas with her children. It was chaotic. Some weeks, between our family and theirs, there were 12 people living and sleeping in a room intended for two. During the day, we shared the same space, but at night, we pulled the curtain across the room, which was meant to give us privacy. But you could still see and hear everything. A shadow puppet show. My mother and father slept on a single mattress, our only piece of furniture, which took up a third of our space. During the day, my mother stored our pots and pans beneath the bed, but at night she stacked them in the corner so Lois and George could sleep there. Nation, Simba, and I slept on the concrete floor beside them. This was how all the kids lived in Shisamba Singles. I know now this place is called a slum, but for me, it was home. I imagined Caitlin's life as very different from mine, and I was excited to learn more about it and her. The little I knew about America, I had learned on television. Several thousand people lived in Shisamba Singles, but there were only a few TV sets in the entire settlement. One was a 15-inch black and white set owned by a man who worked as a manager at the same paper factory where my father worked. Whenever World Wrestling Federation with Hulk Hogan came on, or the A-Team with Mr. T, people would cram into his living room and gather around his house, trying to watch through his window. I sometimes climbed onto Nation's shoulders to get a better look as others peered through the door. As soon as I got home that afternoon, I showed my mother Caitlin's letter. I did not think my mom would mind that Caitlin was a girl. She was too far away to get in any kind of trouble with. And I was right. You can learn many things from her, Martin, my mother said, smiling. I wanted to write Caitlin back immediately, but I had to do my chores first. First, I had to change out of my school uniform. I had only one. It was a pair of green shorts and a green shirt, which I wore every day and washed twice a week, on Wednesday and then again on the weekend. My siblings and I each got a uniform every Christmas and had to make it last the entire school year. I changed into my regular t-shirt and shorts, which hung from my nail. We each had one, and then I went to gather wood for the fire. Our family shared a fire pit, which was directly outside our home, with four other families. There, my mother cooked over a fire in a large metal can once used for cooking oil that we now used as a stove. This way, we could move the fire into the house if it was raining. My father left every morning at 6 to head to work at the factory and returned by 7 p.m. We'd usually hear him singing before we saw him, his husky voice bellowing a liberation song by Thomas Mapfumo, a Zimbabwean legend, or It's Only Rock and Roll, But I Like It. My father loved the Rolling Stones, Cream, and Led Zeppelin too. Baba, I'd shout and start running past women selling tomatoes or mangoes on the side of the road, dipping beneath the clotheslines that crisscrossed between the dozen of identical wooden slab shacks. Nation and Simba would always come running too. My father used to surprise us with small gifts, perhaps a piece of paper from the factory, or a pen, or a coin for each of us to spend on a pack of peanuts. And he'd usually bring something for my mother to cook, greens or a bag of chicken feet. But these days, he was mostly empty-handed. My dad used the word inflation to explain why we no longer ate bread, which rose in price overnight from $2 to $5. Back home, we'd gather around the fire to eat, sitting on stones or overturned cans made into stools. My mother dished out sadza, a cornmeal porridge that is our staple food. Sometimes we had collard greens too, which were common and cheap. Chicken was a once-a-year Christmas treat. We'd get beans from time to time if our father could afford it, but lately it was mostly just sadza. After dinner, Nation and I had to wash the dishes before we could start our homework. Electricity was rationed from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m., though sometimes it did not come on at all. That night, I wrote my letter by the light of the fire. I knew Caitlin was a girl, and I assumed she was white, which made me even more curious about her. White people lived in Zimbabwe, but I didn't know any personally. I had only ever seen a white person up close once before, when a group of people from the Netherlands came to visit our school. They were very pale. They practically glowed in the dark. They also smelled very sweet, like flowers. We called that the white smell. I think it was from deodorant. We used soap when we could, but if we ran out, we just bathed with water. That was all I had to compare to Caitlin. I wondered if she glowed in the dark and smelled like flowers. Did she know Hulk Hogan, or was she just a regular kid like me? I did not want to overwhelm her with all my questions. Instead, I wrote a basic letter using hers as my guide. I told her what grade I was in and the names of my siblings. I told her that I loved to play soccer and that I really hoped we'd continue to write each other. I promised her I would not let her down, and I hoped she would do the same.
October 1997. Caitlin. After I sent my pen pal letter off to Zimbabwe, I continued on with my life, which, in seventh grade, consisted of spending a lot of time obsessing about how I looked. I changed outfits several times every morning before settling on one. Wide-legged jeans and platform sneakers were popular back then. And then, I spent another 30 minutes on my hair. This was around the same time that my brother, Richie, started calling me the Queen, or Princess, or Prinny for short. He thought I was spoiled, and I thought he was a jerk, because he was. That fall, I came home one day to find that he had hung several of my stuffed animals from my ceiling fan, each with a noose around its neck. It was like a scene from a horror movie, but also classic Richie. He called himself a survivalist and liked to wear camouflage and collect skulls of animals he found in the woods behind our house or on the side of the road. He had a cat, a beaver, a possum, a snapping turtle, and a pig that he got after my parents had a pig roast in our backyard. He also had a dart gun and practiced shooting at a target in his room. I could hear the suck and thump of the darts being launched and landing on his wall through mine. He had another bullseye in our backyard where he liked to practice archery with his compound bow. I was actually glad that he would graduate high school before I started. I didn't want anyone to know that I was related to him. I had just untied the last teddy bear when I heard Richie clomping up the stairs. Quickly, I hid behind my closed door. As his footsteps grew louder, I jumped out and shouted, "Hiya!" and karate kicked him in the stomach. I heard the air leave his mouth with a big "Pah!" as he doubled over. When he stood back up, he lunged for me. "You little," he said, just as I slammed my door shut. Through the now locked door, I shouted, "Stay out of my room!" That night at dinner, I started telling my mom what Richie had done when he came to the table. "You already got your revenge," he said, glaring at me. "Wait until I get mine."
"What's this about?"
We heard my dad's voice from the den. He had just returned from a business trip and was still wearing his trench coat and sunglasses. We teased him that it was his Men in Black look.
Get any aliens today, Dad?
Richie asked.
I would tell you,
he said as he took off his glasses.
But then, I'd have to kill you.
My dad was about to sit down when I asked, Seriously, Dad, what do you do? Every year, all my new friends and teachers ask, What type of work is your father in? And I never have a good enough answer.
Tell them I work for the government doing energy contracts, he said.
I do, I said, exasperated. But what does that mean?
It means I signed a contract with the government that said I would never talk about my work with anyone, including my family, he said.
He then winked at me and started helping himself to dinner. When I was young, I imagined that my dad was a spy and worked for the CIA. As I grew older, I realized he was around too much for that to be true. While he sometimes flew to California or overseas on business, he was never gone for more than a few days. Otherwise, he was home by 6 p.m. for dinner and found time to coach my softball team in sixth grade. Not very James Bond-esque. Over dinner, we usually talked about what was happening at school. I filled them in on my classes and talked about my softball games, which my dad coached, but all I really cared about was boys. I kept a diary of all my crushes in my bedroom closet. My mom let me write on the walls there. She called it my sacred space. That October, I made my first closet confession. With a Kelly Green Sharpie, I wrote 10/18/1997 and I love Matt Johnson. Matt was in my algebra class, and while I generally hated math, I loved that class because I got to sit behind Matt. He played soccer, a cool sport at my school, and had wavy brown hair that almost touched his shoulders. Other than dreaming of kissing Matt Johnson, I did start to wonder if my pen pal had received my letter. Kids in my English class had started receiving theirs from Europe. By late October, I still had not received mine. I checked the mailbox every afternoon as soon as I got off the bus and felt disappointed each time there was nothing for me. I got concerned. What if my letter didn't make it all the way to Africa? Or what if my pen pal didn't like my letter? Then, one day, a week before Halloween, I saw it amongst the catalogs and bills and coupon flyers. The envelope was a pale blue-gray, small and square, and plastered with colorful stamps that took up one-third of its surface. I ripped it open right there in the driveway. It read, Hello, Caitlin. Thank you for your letter. I am very happy to have a friend in America. My name is Martin. I live in Mutare, the third largest city in Zimbabwe. I am 14 years old, the second oldest of four brothers. Their names are Nation, Simba, and George. I have one younger sister called Lois. I like soccer very much, and I love school, especially math. I stood in the driveway reading as Kava and Romy did their welcome dance around me. I felt the same kind of jittery excitement that I experienced every Christmas morning in anticipation of all those gifts. I had a new friend. His name was Martin, and he lived thousands of miles away. I ran into the house, clutching my letter like a winning lottery ticket. I got it! I shouted, as I plopped my book bag down on the kitchen floor and waved the letter in the air. It finally came! My mother was in the kitchen, unpacking groceries.
What does it say?
She asked, leaving the bags on the counter to sit next to me at the kitchen table. I read it out loud and looked at her with wide eyes when I got to the names of his brothers. The only Simba I know is from The Lion King, I said.
I don't think he's named after a cartoon lion cub, Caitlin, my mom said.
I didn't either, but I wanted to know who he was named after. And Nation, too.
I immediately whipped out a piece of college-lined paper from my English folder to write him back. Dear Martin, thank you so much for your letter. It was so great to get it. I paused, stumped. I assumed Martin was black, because I thought everyone in Africa was black. And so I figured that Martin was like the black kids who went to middle school with me. Kids who lived in houses and listened to music and ate pizza and did homework, just like me. I didn't have many close black friends, though. Not since Marlena. We were best friends in kindergarten, until I got in trouble for messing up her hair. It was always done up with either elaborate braids that zigzagged over her scalp or teeny poofy ponytails that sprouted all over her head, bound by bright pink and orange elastics with marble-sized pom-poms. Intrigued, I pulled one off and watched in amazement as her hair slowly uncoiled. I thought it was the coolest thing until she cried, "Don't touch my hair!" Her small face crumpled as I saw tears spring from her eyes. She was upset, and I was confused. "But you braid my hair all the time," I protested. "But my hair is different," she said, before stomping off to tell the teacher. That afternoon, my mother had to explain to me that I was not allowed to touch people without their permission. "Marlena braids my hair every day at recess," I replied.
"That's fine if you don't mind it," my mother said. "But it probably takes much longer for Marlena's mom to style her hair, and so she doesn't want you messing it up."
I had never thought about race until that moment. And even after that, I didn't want to see Marlena or any of the black kids in Hatfield as any different from me, nor did I see Martin that way. I know it may sound naive, but I thought then, as a 12-year-old girl, what I think now. Regardless of the color of our skin, we're all the same. I wondered what Martin looked like and how I could find out. And then I had an idea. I'd send him my photo and ask him to send me his. I had just had my photos taken earlier that fall. My mom took me to a professional studio at the mall right after I got my hair cut, a shoulder-length bob. I was wearing my brand-new blue-and-white striped button-down shirt. The photographer had me sit on a high black stool and do all these poses like I was modeling. I selected a wallet-sized picture and wrote on the back, "Please send me your photo so I can see what you look like, too." When I was finished writing the letter, I used my Crayola stampers to decorate the margins. As I pushed the different tips onto the page, each left its own mark, either a small smiley face, a heart, an exclamation point, or, my favorite, a pair of puckered lips. I then placed my photo and letter in an envelope and used my markers to make small hearts and stars to spell out "airmail" on both sides of the envelope. I ran downstairs and handed it to my mom, who promised to send it off first thing in the morning. At school the next day, when Mrs. Miller asked, "Did anyone get a reply?" I jumped from my seat and walked proudly up to the front of the class, holding my letter as if it were a rare artifact. As I approached the blackboard, I could not help but think, Africa is way cooler than Europe.
November 1997. Martin. Mrs. Jarai was smiling again. As everyone took a seat, I could see she was holding a very festive and colorful letter in her hand. "We have our first response," Mrs. Jarai announced, handing the letter to me. A row of hearts and stars framed my name and address, each perfectly drawn in different colors. A rainbow of blue, red, yellow, green, and orange. I opened it immediately, careful not to rip the excellent artwork, as my deskmates leaned in for a closer look. When I unfolded the letter, a small snapshot fell onto my desk. I could not believe my pen pal would send me something so precious. Photos are very rare and quite expensive in Zimbabwe. I picked up her photo off my desk and was struck by how sweet Caitlin looked, like an angel. Her hair was so blonde, it looked like gold. By then, other students were gathered around my desk, wanting to have a look. I handed the photo to Mrs. Jarai so she could hold it up for everyone to see and quickly scanned her letter. My heart was racing as I read each sentence. Caitlin wrote about her hobbies and wanted to know mine. And then she asked about the climate in Zimbabwe. I was already thinking of how I would respond when Mrs. Jarai returned the photo to me. That's when I saw that Caitlin had written a note on its back. She wanted my photo in return. My heart went from sprinting to a standstill. This request was difficult, if not impossible. It worried me through all of my classes that day and all the way home too. I did not know anyone who owned a camera. The only way to get a photo was to hire a professional photographer to come to your house. That cost a lot of money. I wondered if this was the same in America. Caitlin's picture looked very professional. I couldn't even tell where it was taken. Somewhere inside? The background was sky blue, like her shirt. I was so touched that Caitlin would send me something so special, and I wanted to return the favor, but wasn't sure how. And that was not my only worry. As I was leaving class, Mrs. Jarai said, "Martin, I'm so happy that your pen pal has written again, but the school does not have the funds to send letters for you anymore. I hope your parents will help you keep up this important correspondence." I understood. Stamps were very expensive in Zimbabwe, but so were bread, tea, and milk, and many other things we used to eat regularly that were now rare treats. Inflation was continuing to rise, which meant my father's paycheck bought less and less food. How could I possibly ask for a photograph to be taken, as well as stamps, when we had not eaten bread in more than a month? Since food had gotten noticeably more expensive, my mother started sending me to pick up my father's paycheck every 2 weeks before he had a chance to spend it on chibuku, a popular alcoholic beverage made from sorghum or maize. It came in a carton that you shake before you drink to mix the citrusy sediment that settles on the bottom. My father preferred beer, but chibuku was cheaper and had the same effect. And he liked to have a good time, especially at the end of a long work week. So my job was to collect his pay before he had a chance to celebrate. After my mother used it to buy food and pay our rent and utilities, there was no money for breakfast tea, let alone alcohol. I loved this task. It took my father an hour to walk to work every day, but if I ran fast, I could make it there in 20 minutes. The factory was in an industrial area outside of Mutare, as big as a football field. I always entered through the main office where the men in suits worked. My dad worked on the factory floor with all the big machines. He wore overalls and rubber boots that covered half his legs. The very first time I went years before, my dad walked me through the entire paper-making process, starting with where the trees come in and are ground to pulp before being turned into paper. He worked the machines at the end of the line, where the paper is rolled into giant bundles. To do this, he had to run up and down a ladder attached to a huge machine and push a variety of buttons that made gigantic cranes move like mechanical dinosaurs to lift the bundles. I was in awe. On this particular day, I found my dad in the break room with a bunch of guys his age who were wearing the same overalls and helmets.
"You must be Martin," one said, "the clever one."
"He always brings your report cards to work," another added with a smile. This made me happy. I liked my father's friends, but I was more fascinated by the managers in the front. They wore suits and talked on the phone and typed on machines. On that visit, my dad introduced me to Mr. Stephen Mutandwa, the head of human resources. I was standing in front of a black man just like my father, but this one was wearing a tie and let me play with his computer. I punched a few keys and some symbols came up. I had to stop myself from saying, "How do I get to be you?" I got my chance later that morning. As I was running home, Mr. Mutandwa pulled up next to me in his rusty pickup truck.
"Do you want a ride, young fellow?" he asked.
I had never been in a car in my life. My heart was racing so fast from my excitement that I could barely breathe. As the car started to move, I grabbed the dashboard with two hands to steady myself. Overwhelmed, I began asking all the questions that had piled up in my head, like, how did you get this car? And how did you become the human resources manager? Where do you live? Where can I get a suit?
Martin, he cut me off. You are clearly a smart boy. You must go to university like I did. That is the only way to truly succeed. Neither my mother nor my father had finished secondary school, so university seemed out of the question. I knew I was smart enough to go, but I also knew it was impossibly expensive, way more than secondary school, which my parents could barely afford for me or my siblings. And yet, sitting in the front seat of Mr. Mutandwa's pickup truck and watching the dust clouds kick up behind us, I thought I must find a way to go. Where did you study? I asked.
The University of Zimbabwe in Harare, he responded.
I want to go there as well, I said.
Mr. Mutandwa smiled. You will, Martin, he said. I know you will.
His confidence in me was contagious. If I studied hard enough and stayed focused, maybe I would get there. Receiving Caitlin's letter gave me a similar confidence. It made me feel special. When I arrived home that afternoon, I showed it to my mother. You will learn so much from her, Martin, she said. Then I removed her photo from my pocket and watched my mother's eyes widen. Very pretty Murungu, she said, smiling. Murungu is Shona for people with white skin. None lived in Shisamba Singles or anywhere nearby. Besides the teachers who had visited my school, I had only ever seen them on TV or during a trip into the city center of Mutare, a 30-minute bus ride from home. Even so, there were not many Murungus, and now I had one as a friend. I was distracted all afternoon. How could I write Caitlin back without a photo? That would be rude. And then, as I was gathering wood for the fire, I heard my father singing in the distance. I ran to greet him, holding Caitlin's photo in one hand, her letter in the other. Baba, look, I said. Caitlin wrote back. I handed him the photo first, which he admired. Then I showed him the letter. He took that too and started waving both in the air.
My son has a new friend in America, he started shouting to nearby people, some neighbors, others strangers passing through.
Chisamba Singles was like a small city. More than 10,000 people lived there, either in shared houses or small shanties built from scraps of metal and wood nearby. I felt a funny mix of embarrassment and pride as my father paraded through the narrow street, boasting of my faraway friend.
Look how beautiful she is,
he said, stopping people to show them her photo.
Martin's new friend looks like a movie star.
Most people smiled. Others ignored him entirely, but I shared his deep enthusiasm. Something about seeing Caitlin's face and sweet smile made me know she was a kind and good person, and to have a face to match her words made our connection seem that much more real. I felt in my heart that this was the start of a true friendship. That night, before I went to sleep, I pinned Caitlin's photo on the wall beside the poster of Hulk Hogan. The next morning, I woke to see Caitlin smiling down on me. As happy as I was to have her photo there, I was also deeply concerned. I wanted to send her a photo of me as she requested, but how? Hiring a photographer cost the same as a week's worth of mealie-meal, the cornmeal used to make satsa. I wrestled with different ideas for a week or so before I finally shared my dilemma with my mother. Her eyes lit up. Martin, do you remember winning the award at school? She asked. 2 years prior, I had scored the highest on a national placement test in my school. Everyone in Zimbabwe took this test at the end of primary school. At our graduation ceremony, the headmaster announced that my score was the highest not only in our school, but in all of Mutare. There was a collective gasp in the audience, followed by an applause that thundered in my bones. I was proud, but Father was even more so. He seemed to grow another inch that afternoon, walking around with his chest puffed out, his smile brighter and bigger than usual. He was so pleased that he asked the photographer who had come to the ceremony to take our photo. In it, I'm wearing my school uniform. My father is standing to my right and Nation is to my left, holding the certificate rolled up like a baton. They are both smiling, but I am looking very serious and staring straight at the camera.